Missing this.
Salah takes the shot. Oh! Oh, Mo Salah with one of the goals of the season. Unbelievable.
Then get this. The all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home. Featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis. Plus, almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The OTB Podcast Network. OTB
AM. So Liverpool are almost there. They can smell it now. They are almost the Premier League champions after a 4-0 victory against Crystal Palace. Brian Kerr was watching this match alongside me, and it was effortlessly brilliant for Liverpool in the end. They just strolled through that game, scored four wonderful goals, and probably gave the reminder that people needed as to how they got themselves in this position where they're 23 points clear.
Yeah, I think it was very important that they got the breakthrough. But when they put out their best team, there's nobody can live with them. They had, I would say, their best team on the pitch tonight. There was an energy and determination about them to get the job done. They were that little bit sharper than they were against Everton in the Merseyside Derby the weekend. But I still didn't think their full cohesion was there or their full rhythm was there. But they were miles better than Palace. And once they got that opening goal in the middle of the first half from Trent Alexander, Arnold taking the free kick, they need to get that breakthrough, because Palace are a stubborn unit. They only conceded 32 goals in the league before tonight in 30 games. So that shows you that the team always capable of getting results and matches. A lot of low-scoring games. They'd won their last four games, 3-1-0 victories and a 2-0 victory. So, you know, you've got to break them down, try and open them up and try and get them to come out of that rigid formation and most organised and disciplined formation that Roy Hodgson has them in. And that opening goal, equally the second goal just before the break, was very important too.
And often, particularly when it's Palace, people will go back to the last time Liverpool lost at Anfield, which is 56 games ago now. It's hard to believe. It's 23 straight victories in the Premier League at Anfield. That one of the things that Jurgen Klopp has changed is he brought a patience to Liverpool's play. That at times when teams were as well organised as Palace were tonight, the crowd, if they were there, would get frustrated, and then the players would get frustrated and they'd make mistakes. That hasn't been seen at all this year. They seem to know how to win against any type of team.
Yes, they're a more experienced team. I think Champions League victory last year helped their confidence and helped their morale in terms of, yes, we've achieved something of quality. They've been hitting the bar, been close, lost the Champions League final. And, you know, second in the league last year, they needed that victory in the Champions League, I think, to really have belief in themselves that they could get over any type of adversary, any loss of players and dodgy goalkeepers to win something as convincingly as they've done with the league this year. I mean, they are going to win it now. That cuts down on the number of points they actually need. They just need two, even if Manchester City do the job against Chelsea tomorrow night. But their play has, they've embellished something in their game. Yes, they're patient when they need to be. They play at a tempo that other teams find it difficult to live with. They don't make too many errors defensively. They recover from them. They sometimes make errors and they get away with them because Alisson's such an outstanding goalkeeper. And players who come into the team generally fill in and do the job they're required to do. They've also not had too many injuries this year of the key man. And that helps, obviously. The rotation that's required hasn't done them any damage. They know they can rely on the squad. And you see tonight they're starting to bring in some of the young players that they'll be hoping in the future can replace some of the senior players. But at the moment, the team is so young. I mean, Milner's really the only one over 30 in the team.
Mo Salah is a player who still, it seems at times, divides opinion, despite the fact in two full seasons at the club he's finished the Premier League top scorer both times. Could do it this season. He's on 21 in all competitions now for the season. Was tonight sort of a typical Mo Salah performance? Brilliantly taken goal, worked his ass off, yet at times frustrating with his passing, and also a bit sloppy at times in front of goals.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. I think Mo Salah is at his best when Liverpool don't have so much of the ball as they have tonight, when he has room to run in behind defenders. And that sensational season when he scored, what was it, 44 goals 2 years ago? You know, I mean, last season he got 22 league goals. This year he's on 17, 32 season before. That's phenomenal scoring for someone who's not, as I've said before, is not always in the centre-forward position. But what suits him best is when teams play a bit of a high line or try to attack Liverpool, leave space behind for the counter-attacking ball over the top. Now, one of the ways teams have adapted their game to try to frustrate Liverpool this year is to play deeper lines and keep the full-backs in position and be aware that Salah is always going to be waiting on that long diagonal ball running in behind, or maybe making a diagonal run onto a straight ball. Teams have made it more difficult for him this year, and when it's more crowded, he hasn't been as successful. They try to stop on his left foot and stop him shooting when he's coming inside off the right to the left to get the shot in. But still, despite that, he's scoring 17 goals is a lot of goals in the league still. But, you know,
are people being harsh, or should you expect
more? I think people are being harsh, but I don't think there is that much criticism. I think overall Liverpool supporters love Mo Salah, and they, you know, as they love this team, the excitement, the style, the gung-ho action, all let's get forward. Yes, we leave the two centre backs back and Fabinho hangs around, but it's such an exciting attacking style of play, not allowing the opposition get out of their own half if at all possible. A brave, courageous way of playing. So I think it's nitpicking a bit to pick on Salah and say, oh yeah, he should score more goals, or he should be more precise with his passing, or he shouldn't be as selfish. I think, you know, you look at his record, scoring goals, the hardest thing to do in football, and he scores loads of them.
By the time Liverpool come back to Anfield in 10 days' time to play Aston Villa, they could well be champions, either by Manchester City failing to beat Chelsea in our live game tomorrow night, or we'll have the game on Thursday week, which everyone's so looking forward to, City against Liverpool, where if Liverpool get a point there again, they'll be champions. We've seen how good City have been over the couple of games since they came back against Arsenal and against Burnley. Jurgen Klopp remarked that watching Manchester City last night, he couldn't understand how Liverpool had managed to go 20 points clear. Can you understand how there is such a gap, 23 points now, that a team of Manchester City's quality are that far behind this Liverpool team?
Well, I do understand it, because City have lost so many games, I think 7 games in the league, and they have been deficient in defence. I mean, the main criticism has been they didn't replace Vincent Kompany, but none of the players replaced Vincent Kompany, and they didn't do as well. The full backs were, I think, other opposition found out and practiced and rehearsed in a better way how to exploit Manchester City's deficiency. So they conceded more goals, probably, I'd say, about 2.5 times, I'd say, the goals they conceded last season, or certainly more goals they conceded last season. On a more regular basis in big games, they've lost goals. So that's why Liverpool have been more consistent. Liverpool have been able to, in some games, just kind of scrap it out and battle it out and get over the line. And, you know, we've seen the games, I mentioned the West Ham game before, when it looked like that was slipping away and they turned it around 1-3-2. But
well, you think of the big scores City have racked up this season. They've 8-0s, they've 5s, they've 6s. Yeah. 4-0 is a big victory.
Yeah, but they've also lost matches like the Norwich match and the Wolves match as well. And, you know, so that's what's made the difference. Liverpool have had the hunger. Maybe Manchester City haven't had quite the same hunger about it, because they've had success. They've won a couple of leagues recently. They've core group with the same players. They've been a bit unlucky with some injuries for defensive players, but not in the attacking position, but the defensive. And you look at the style of Pep Guardiola, and he always goes for it, and he is not inclined and has never been inclined to put much emphasis on defence, whereas Klopp was forced into making defensive signings that ultimately changed Liverpool into the class outfit they are. I mean, it's been said so often, the signing of the goalkeeper Alisson Becker and the signing of the centre half have been the two most significant moves that Liverpool made this year. Who did they sign? Adrian. They had to play him because the goalkeeper got hurt in the first game of the season, and he did his job. And, you know, there was nobody thinking, no, he's a great signing from West Ham, they let him go, but he's done all right. Other than that, who did they sign? Minamino? Didn't sign anyone else of significance.
No, didn't sign Minamino till Christmas either.
That's what I say, he came in. So they worked off last year's squad, and they had the hunger from the outset, and they got off on the run in the beginning, And they've more or less done it now.
Just one other story from this week is what's been going on with Burnley on the pitch. So I think last week we spoke to you about the Black Lives Matter movement, and we saw the nonsensical airplane being flown over, and probably no point talking about that. But Burnley on the pitch, and Jeff Hendrick's position, and the position Sean Dyche has found himself in, where the players either refused to play or weren't being selected, and now we see that Jeff Hendrick is leaving the club. Like, it's an unintended consequence of what's happening. Is leaving Burnley right now the right thing for Jeff Hendrick, do you think?
Well, first, I don't think we should just skip the Black Lives Matter issue, because I think what happened the other night at the match was dreadful. Mm. And that somebody in that community that may have called himself a Burnley supporter thought that that was the right thing to do, to go to the bother of hiring an aeroplane, spending the money on it, and getting that banner composed to hang behind an aeroplane is just disgusting. But unfortunately, Burnley had a reputation in the past of being one of the most racist towns, big towns in Britain, and, you know, has elected far-right politicians in the past. Now, that thankfully in recent years that has dissipated to some degree, but obviously there's an element of people around who supported the contents of that banner. So it's really sad for Burnley Football Club and for the good people of Burnley. But, you know, it has to be dealt with, and dealt with firmly, if they can identify who was involved in that. Secondly, if you talk about the team, it almost seems most un-Burnley-like, because we've seen Burnley and admired them as a kind of very unified club. Their manager and the team seem to be almost totally cohesive in the style, and they came up from the championship, and they found a way to battle and scrap and become a solid Premier League team off a small budget, of a relatively small town or city, and with a playing style that was functional but not didn't receive too much criticism. And then they signed some good players, and they signed Jeff Hendrick, and they signed Brady, and we had an Irish interest, and Kevin Long was playing. But now suddenly they seem to be a little bit, there's obviously a severe tension between the manager and the chairman, the board, and the plans for the future in relation to the players. And we see Sean Dyche coming out saying that they basically saying they didn't do what I've told them to do. I've lived within their means. I've never been particularly demanding in terms of wages, and when we've had to sell players, I've put up with it. But now he's kind of saying the club haven't acted on what I've said, and they've left me with what I have. That's what I would have taken over. And we saw a most un-Burnley-like performance tonight against City, where they almost, you know, he looked like he'd thrown in the towel before the match, and not naming, what do you name?
Seven subs, two goalkeepers,
and a few young lads on it. You know, it's a strange situation. But for Jeff Hendrick, obviously he's allowed his contract to run down, the last year of his contract. I haven't been talking to Eamon McLaughlin, his agent, recently. I'm sure Eamon would have an explanation for that. Obviously, Jeff has ambitions to play with a team who maybe he sees himself as being good enough to play for a team that might be in contention higher up the league than Burnley have been, whether in the Premier League or Italy, has been suggested.
Italy be exciting, just because it's so rare for an Irish player to go abroad like that. And it probably does show where football is right now, that it's Burnley or AC Milan, and I don't know if there's a huge wage gap between what the two of them can play.
Well, I'd imagine
AC Milan is not what it was, obviously,
no,
20 years
but the,
ago.
But the point about AC Milan is that, you know, like the Italian clubs have been, they seem to have pounced on English players who have been out of contract. Inter Milan in particular have been very strong in recruitment of Premier League players in recent, who were out of contract and were able to pay them big sign-on fees and wages. So Jeff Hendrick might come into that category. I don't think he's played particularly well for either Burnley or Ireland recent season, but I think he's fairly highly thought of around the game, because I think he's a very good guy, and he's a good professional, and he's respected by his teammates. And I would imagine that managers and coaches in the game respect him as a very steady, honest player that can play in a lot of positions without grumbling about where he plays, and contributes to the team very much. So there's a value in that, and maybe some of the Italian teams see that. I would think from his personal point of view, yes, if that opportunity is there, he should grasp it and take the education that could go with playing in the Italian league and the learning that he could have in that. And if there is extra money involved in it, good luck to him. Maybe the Irish team will gain some advantage out of what he learns playing Italian football.
Maybe we'll have to get Syria our rights and keep a closer eye on him.
Yeah, maybe we should go to some games, Nathan.
Any game right now, we take, Brian.
And investigate.
See, the trip to Tala on a Friday night has never been more appealing.
Investigate his performance in detail. Maybe even go to the training ground and have a look.
You got it. All right, great stuff as always, Brian.
Thank you. OTB AM.
Now, I'm delighted to say we've got Kenny Cunningham and Jonathan Walters with us. Lads, you're both very welcome. Jonathan, I want to start with you because I know that you've had some personal tragedy in your family recently and you're raising money for it with a raffle and some amazing prizes, particularly for Republic of Ireland fans. It's the jersey that you scored a very famous goal for us in.
Yeah, look, the beginning of the month, my cousin who lived in Australia, he's from that south, but He's a chef and he'd married recently. And he had a 2-year-old son and he passed away very suddenly and sadly and unexpectedly. And he's left behind obviously a young wife and a 2-year-old son. He was the only one who worked in the family. So, you know, the whole family are trying to get together and get some money and try and support them and help them in any way we can. So I thought, you know, one of the most important things during my playing career was actually I played in that night against Bosnia. So that one, the match one shirt I had from that match, and rather than do it an auction or through eBay or anything like that, I thought I'd do it in a raffle way where, you know, I just said make a donation to a Just Giving page, which all goes to support, you know, his widow and his 2-year-old son. And I think I said, but you know, a $5 Australian donation, which is about £2.50, £2.60, something like that over here. And I'll pick a random one over the next couple of weeks to win it.
Sorry, how do people make the donation? What, like, we'll tweet the link to it, obviously, if anybody isn't here. But what's the easiest way to get onto that, Jonathan?
Just on my social media pages, so through Twitter and Instagram. I think I've left the link in my sort of bio right at the top of the page. You just click on that link, it takes you straight to it.
And there's obviously also Burnley, Ipswich and other various jerseys from your career as well. From an Ireland perspective, obviously, that was a hugely special night for us. So hopefully hundreds and thousands of people will actually just donate and be with a chance of winning that. So. And we'll, as I said, we'll retweet that tweet, that the original one. So if anybody is looking for it, let's talk a little bit about football. Jonathan, we talked at the very start about this, about football coming back behind closed doors, and it seems like then you were very much of the opinion that it's not going to be quite the real deal. How do you feel now, watching it with the crowd noise or watching it without crowd noise?
I think that's the biggest bugbear for me. We all love football being back. You know, for so long without it, everyone was desperate for it to come back. But Kenny will know this. The game's not the same as with the fans in the stadium. I think players feed off the energy that the atmosphere that they create in the stadium. And without that, it's just not the same. It's almost like some teams are not going through the motions, but it just seems a pre-season friendly type game. And you can tell the teams like City, Wolves, Liverpool, those teams that'll be so difficult to play against in this type of game. It's a completely different match for me than, you know, no one playing it. I think it's a completely different match than when fans are in the stadium. So that's a difficult thing. And I've got to switch the fan noise off because, you know, it's not real. I like to hear what people are saying as well, with a bit of communication on the pitch.
Kenny, what are you watching, with or without the crowd noise?
Well, I haven't got the option. I wouldn't know how to switch it off, to be honest. I don't mind the crowd noise. I understand what John's saying, but I've been listening to it on the kind of German football there for a while, and it seems a lot better. I think the timing's everything, John, with the crowd noise. There's no point when a shot whistles over the crossbar and 3 seconds later you hear the big oof from the... Yeah. So for me, the timing is absolutely everything. I don't mind it so much, actually, the bit of noise. And I take John's point in regards to level of intensity in some of the games. I've noticed a distinct difference between some of the kind of German, even the Italian. I've watched some of the Italian football of late, the Coppa Italia semi-finals. Don't know if you have, John. And it's been good quality games. The tempo, the energy levels have been high. Good tempo to the games, moving the ball well. Almost the fitness levels of the players seem to be at a higher level than some of the English teams that I've seen. So that's interesting. Just in terms of how that comes back to maybe how the teams have been training, their physical conditioning during the time they've been off. But by and large, I've enjoyed the football. The games last night were okay, although a little bit one-sided. I enjoyed Chelsea's performance at Aston Villa the weekend, even the Spurs-Manchester United game, particularly second half. I thought it was a decent standard. Yeah, there has been a little bit of dross sprinkled around that, but by and large, it's good to have the football back.
Can I just specifically, sorry, Dave, before you come in on that, the Chelsea game at the weekend, Damien Delaney was on COCOM for us and made a great point with 5 minutes left to go. Villa are chasing it. They're at the bottom of the table. They're at home. They just need to lump the ball forward and get the crowd going and put a bit of pressure on Chelsea, and it was flat. There was nothing happening. There was no even kind of, there was no cavalry charge in the last 10 minutes. And it seems to me that actually that's a real thing. The crowd G'ing the team up, putting a bit of pressure on the opposition, that is a real thing that, like, we have now, that's gone. And that those teams at the bottom of the table, they're not going to be scraping out last minute equalisers.
No, I think the only way you're going to get that is a bit of fatigue in the last, you see the teams that are a little bit fitter in the last 5 or 10 minutes, because that'll be a huge factor. But definitely, look, I said all along, people get a bit nervous the last 5 or 10 minutes of the game. The fans really give you that energy in the stadium. You feel it as a player. You feel the whole momentum going your way, especially when you're chasing something and you're fighting for something. So I think that's the biggest difference you will see is there was always a team that went on a late run, wasn't there? You know, Sunderland did it for so many years, and the crowd right behind him used to get so many late-minute goals. I don't think we'll see that this year.
Kenny, I'd be interested in getting your thoughts on that as well, because I know, unfortunately for you in your career, you did have some experience of what it was like to be in a relegation scrap. And I've heard guys like Gary Breen, Kevin, talking about the tension already within a team that is battling against the drop when they're playing in front of their own fans. There's almost a sense of anxiety from the kickoff that something's going to go wrong, that as soon as a player puts a ball out of play or overhits a pass or misses an open goal, that the whole energy drains out of the stadium, and that in the first half in particular, it can get on top of a particularly young team. So if you flip that, I get Jared's point on the last 10 minutes. If you want the whole 10 at Villa Park right behind you for a final 10-minute charge. But for the rest of the game, is there a way that it could actually help some of the teams who are looking to avoid the drop, that it's just them, it's just the 11 players on the pitch, and they don't have to worry about what's going on in the stands?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. For me, it is a twin-edged sword. I've played in relegation teams almost entirely the course of my career. And it does, those moments, like last 6-8 games of the season, those home games, there's almost a fear factor there. Generally speaking, you're not playing well. The confidence levels are low. There's tension in the crowd. There might be an initial surge of enthusiasm when you come on the pitch, the opening period to the game. But very quickly, that can dissipate. One misplaced pass, missed tackle, overhit pass, and very quickly you can get a sense of that tension and players retreat into their shells. So in some respects, you could argue no home support for the teams in the relegation end of the tables actually should be an advantage, maybe not having that that tension around the stadium amongst the home supporters, because it does translate to the players. And I've seen kind of younger players kind of fold a little bit in that kind of environment. I just think it's overplayed a little bit, actually, the actual crowd for me. I understand the arguments for and against, but for me, they're very minuscule. And I think it's pretty weak, to be honest with you, when I hear people talking about players losing their focus. There's no crowd there. They're just drifting mentally. They can't quite get themselves focused where they need to be. I just think you're in a pretty weak mental state if that's the case. I mean, John will know. I mean, by and large, training sessions even, you come into the training ground in midweek, the manager sticks up an 11v11, all the bibs are out. Might be maybe 30 minutes each way on the training pitch, kind of proper game. They've been some of the most kind of intense games I've ever played on the training pitch against your own players, like pretty sterile environment. But it's kind of game on. It's a competitive game of football, and you should really be able to zone in and get on with it. Shouldn't be a question mark in terms of, well, there's no crowd here and I'm not really feeling. I just can't quite get myself to the level that I need to be at. when I start hearing that those things come out of a football club from players at certain football clubs, I begin to get very worried about their prospects going forward. If that's the kind of mentality, if that's how brittle the mentality is among certain players at a football club.
I don't know about that, Kenny. I think you look at home form in teams, you look at home form and how down the years, home form's huge for teams. Every pitch is the same. You can say you go on a training pitch, they make the pitches exactly the same as a stadium, and near enough every pitch is the same. So there is something there, whether it's familiarity of your home stadium, and you can go into the mental state of players, and people have looked at it down the years, how do you... Can you change the hotel? Can you bring your own pillows? Can you do that? Can you make it as homely as possible? There is something there, but there's also certain individuals that will also feed off the crowd. Or I think of one off the top. Craig Bellamy was a good one. Craig Bellamy used to feed off the hate that the crowd used to give him. And you have people like that. And I used to, in a way, I used to enjoy the crowd being there. And it's different. But you always remember those 11v11 games. A training game and you'll play against, sometimes you'll bring the under-18s over and the 23s over. Sometimes you'll play the 11 that are not playing, we'll play against the 11 that are playing the next day. And a lot of the times, the team that you wouldn't think would win, it wouldn't be the first team that would win the game or give it a good game. It'll be the bomb squad or the young lads that'll turn the first team over. So I don't know. For me, I think for me they do play a huge part. But you're right in what you're saying. You can't blame it on the crowd. You can't say, oh, the crowd's not getting me going. You're a professional footballer. You should be getting up there. But there is something there. And as a player, I always fed off the energy of the crowd, whether it be for or against me.
What about those teams who are in limbo, where they're not in a relegation battle and they're not really going to be troubling either the Champions League or qualifying for Europe? It looks like some of those teams, Palace, for example, are not as sharp maybe as they would have been if this game, last night's game, for example, had been played when it was supposed to be played. Is it very hard for that team to get motivated to come back into, I don't know how many seasons you would have been involved in where you would have been safe with 7-8 games left to go, Jonathan, and like...
A shake of the head from Kenny there.
Not many. Safe with 7 games to go. You're mad.
There's always something to play for, isn't there? There's always, as a player, you always say a manager's what? 3 games, 4 games away from the sack. If a manager gets beaten 4 games on a run, the pressure's on him. So there's always things to play for. There's always, especially now, I think there's a great chance to throw young players in with no crowd, getting on the back there a little bit and give them a chance to shine and feel like they can do well in a Premier League setting. There's always those players coming through. There's players going for contracts. There's a lot of teams always trying to get in this sort of top 10, you know, we need to get in the top 10. But, the clubs, there's so much money at stake for every place. Managers are on bonuses, players are on bonuses. There's all sorts of things thrown into the mix. I'll never say there's nothing to play for.
Some players, John. John, you must remember being part of squads where you were safe with 10 games to go. And not every professional would have had the same attitude as you. Can you recall guys you would have been playing with where you can noticeably see a drop-off in their application levels because mentally maybe they've already checked out?
Just trying to think. Probably the majority of the time was at Stoke, wasn't I? We were always desperate to get in the top 10. I think we missed out on it by the last game, about 2 or 3 seasons. The manager was fuming because I think he was on a big bonus if he got in the top 10. And I'm trying to think. There was always one or two that just went sort of, I'd switch off and start going out more and being late for training and things like that. You could see a mental shift on a couple, but I think it's up to the group of players. And we had a strong group, so we wouldn't let it sort of go. And there was always a thing about Tony Pulis's team, wasn't it? He dropped off after they got safe. But it wasn't the case of us at Stoke. I think we were always trying to go for it. But, you know, the last couple of weeks, we had a couple of people go missing for a couple of weeks. A few nights out, it just carried on, I think, all the way. And things like that. But
I never got a night out. I think, lads, there's a point there. I've been inside start. The one thing I used to hate start of the season, John, you and I ahead, when manager stood in front of the players and first thing he said was, right, 40 points, lads. 40 points. This was before the ball had been kicked at the start of the season. And you hear that repeated week in, week out for like the first kind of 5 months of the season. And I think it does affect the mentality a little bit. If you do get into that position kind of February, March, April, you hit that 38, 40-point barrier. You've heard it so often during the season, this is what we're striving for, 40 points, staying up, staying out of relegation. This is all that matters. When you do reach that point, it almost is, there is a mental switch of the button in your head. Very difficult for the manager then, having been preaching this mantra of 40 points, 40 points all season, to suddenly stand in front of the players again at the start of April and say, listen, lads, forget about those 40 points we've been talking about all season. Let's kind of reset and go again for 50 or European football. So I always cringe when I hear the manager early in the season. We know the teams generally are going to be competing at the end of the season, who come out and say it's all about staying up, 38 points, that's all we're interested in. We're interested in nothing above that. Because for me, that's planting the wrong seed in the mindset, of the, in the psyche of your players.
No, I'd agree. There was a lot of managers that would do that, and you'd see them switch off, and anything else is a bonus after that 38, 40 points. The longer you get into the season, you look at Southampton, Brighton now, they're like that now. Two more wins, we get to 39, 40 points. But I think at the start of the season, you're right. We had a really good one with Mark Hughes at Stoke when he came in. He used to break the season down into, I think it was five sections, and he'd get all the teams and the games up, and he'd say, come on, get your points. Get where do you think you'll win? Where do you think you'll lose? And it was surprising where you think you could get to, and results wouldn't go your way. And if you hit certain targets during the season, but he was all about breaking records. Can we break the record from last year? Can we have most goals scored, most wins, most home wins, most away wins? And he set a good structure up all the way through. And to be fair, you can say it worked, because every season he went on, I think at Stoke, he broke some sort of record of where the club was progressing in terms of placing the table or consecutive top 10 finishes. Can you get into 9-8? Where can you break up to? Can you push it for Europa League? So I like that the way he did it, rather than at the start of the season, you're saying 38, 40 points, yeah.
It's funny, we just had Pat Lam on, who was the Connacht coach that won a Pro 14, and now he's at Bristol Bears, and he was saying, you know, you actually need to aim really high, because if you don't aim really high, then you begin to settle and you make accommodations along the way, and all of a sudden it's very hard to shift that mindset from, yeah, we're trying to reach... So he was talking about Ireland in rugby and how, yeah, we really want to reach a World Cup semi-final, and he's like, why not try and win it, lads? You know, like, actually have that ambition, as opposed to... Because once you get to the semi-final, it's like, well, we can retire now. And that's interesting to hear that Mark Hughes was like that and able to break it down. Was Mark Hughes a good manager?
Yeah. People always say who are your best and who are your worst. And I never pick anyone as a bad manager. Everyone had their own way of doing things. Some managers you'll enjoy more, enjoy the trainer more. The coaches will take it. Some managers really hands-on. Mark, he didn't take the training every day. He took it sometimes. He left it to Eddie Nowitzki and Mark Bowen, and the training was really good, really enjoyable. Damien Roden had a big part of that. And then he was quite quiet. He'd step in when he's needed. He didn't particularly like confrontation. Some managers would like that, but I don't think you can look at his sort of record with Stoke over the years and say he did a bad job, because we were in the top 10 so many times, and that was the aim of the club, to keep on progressing. You can probably question signings towards the end of his tenure at Stoke, but then you've got to throw a director of football and other people into the mix as well, and how many decisions does he make? So, you know, I enjoyed it with him. I enjoyed my time with him. I enjoyed Tony Pulis at Stoke. I enjoyed Mark at Stoke, and there was never any ill feelings or anything like that when I got left out towards the end, or when I left the club. I'm never like that with anyone. Don't hold grudges. So I bumped into him a couple of times since leaving Stoke, and I really enjoyed my time with him at Stoke. And it was a really good group of lads, and there's a lot of people to speak to there from the time under Mark.
Yeah, for sure. I want to ask a little bit about Manchester United's performance last night, Kenny. Dave was comparing them to Barcelona a little bit earlier on. I'm not misquoting you there, Dave, am I?
Yes, you are actually, Miss Quatermain. And I mean, it's unsurprising for you, Ger. Kenny, the point, I'll make it on my own behalf, if that's okay, and avoid Ger putting words in my mouth. I was saying at times they looked like Barcelona, but I suspected that was far more to do with the fact they were playing against a weakened Sheffield United team that didn't really put it up to them at all. Because in the last half an hour in particular, I'm not sure Sheffield United had the ball for more than two or three passes. United absolutely dominated them. So how much do you read into the United performance, the qualification being that they weren't really up against much last night?
No, I don't buy into that. You've got to give Sheffield United a lot more credit than that. They've been one of the most organised teams in the Premiership this season, set up really well by the manager. Very cohesive unit, in and out possession in the football. Don't make it easy for you to play. So I don't quite buy in to that. And they're up against no opposition. I think you have to give Manchester United...
Well, they were very poor, Kenny. Very poor against Newcastle earlier in the week. Awful against Newcastle.
Yeah, they weren't great. Like, obviously, they had a man sent off. John got sent off as well, didn't he? But I suppose the point I'm trying to make is I'm looking at Manchester United and their team transformed. And it's no surprise, really. And it's all about that midfield combination. It's having Pogba and Fernandes on the pitch and that midfield area. I mean, it's totally transformed the team from a creative point of view. We've all known about the sprinkling of talent United have high up the pitch with the likes of Martial, Rashford, Young, Greenwood was going to develop into an outstanding player, but it was all about the supply and that central midfield area. Who's got the craft, the quality in terms of their passing ability and that kind of link-up play. And with Hernandez and Pogba now, and those almost two advanced number eight positions, although Pogba at times played a little bit deeper last night, that's the missing part for me, because it's totally transformed the team. I mean, Fernandez's ability to get forward and interact with the front three, Pogba as well, the goal scoring threat which they possessed. They actually look as if now they enjoy playing with each other. I think the last Martial goal, you saw the ball from Pogba head up, picking out Fernandes 20 yards higher up the pitch, a little ball around the corner. That kind of combination play from midfield into forward areas of the pitch, we weren't seeing that the first half of the season for Manchester United. It's a little bit clunkier, the likes of McTominay, Fred and kind of Matic in those midfield areas. No disrespect to them, they're different type of players. So it's a huge plus for Manchester United, and it's the big question between now and the end of the season. Can Solskjaer sit down with Paul Pogba and thrash out his future and get a commitment to Pogba that he's going to, not only is he going to see out next season, but maybe commit himself, medium to long term, to the football club? Because with Pogba and Fernandes and those two number eight positions in midfield, with a whole midfielder behind them, you can take your pick. Fred and McTominay, I'd imagine Matic is not for the medium to long term. Fred, for me, prior to the lockdown, was probably looking like the one he could trust in that holding midfield position. And you need somebody very quick, dynamic in that area, the pitch, defensively minded. Because if you're going to integrate Fernandes and Pogba into the team and those advanced midfield positions, you need to be able to trust that holding midfield to kind of sweep up behind them. But I've liked what I've saw with United. They're playing with real confidence, and it's the kind of presence and personality of Fernandes and Pogba. For me, which has been instrumental and will continue to be so going forward.
John, Martin Tyler asked Gary Neville on commentary last night how surprised he was by the significance of the influence of Fernandes so early. I'd say he was the kind of player you'd love to have played with. Every touch is dripping with intent. It may not always come off, but he's always looking to play the ball forward. He's always looking to play around the corner, always looking to play it in behind. Have you been surprised with the massive influence he's having? He almost looks like a leader of that team already, taking all the set pieces, all the penalties. He's mouthy. We saw him giving a bit of guff to Pep Guardiola before the lockdown. He just seems like he was made to be playing in that United team.
It doesn't surprise me, no, because for me, he's a world-class player. That's why he's gone to a club for such a fee, to Manchester United. And there's nothing better when I was playing, I was always a player that always tried to get him behind. Very rarely would I try to come to feet. My first look would always be getting him behind. And if someone can land on the ball and always look to put you in, there's nothing better. Always looking positive going forward. As a player, as a coach, you sort of coaches going in and saying your first look has always got to be forward. It's always got to be positive. I used to hate players that used to just get it off the defence and pass it back and always go back and keep it slow. If you can go forward. And it looks like he's a player that does that. It's simple, go forward and join it. If you can't go forward, go sideways. If you can't go sideways, go back. It's very simple if you think of it like that, but it's hard to do for some players. It's a safe option sometimes to just play it back and go there. But he looks like he's just slotted in. It doesn't surprise me at all for a player of that stature to go in. And I think Man United needed it. They needed someone in there to really take hold of that midfield. You know, Pogba, who weren't missing, who was injured for a long time, but wouldn't really make an impact. Fred there, McTominay, a young lad. Who was going to get hold of that United midfield and really drive it? And he looks like to be the one. And to be fair, what a signing to pull off. And it seems to be the perfect player that they needed to bring a lot of it all together. And if you've got Martial in front, Rashford in front, pace like that, and people that are always going to try to get him behind, you've got a great combination of their players. You look at the Liverpool team, you look at last night, Salah's goal, as soon as Fabinho landed on it, you have four players that came short and pulled the defence on midfield. There was a big gap. And if you look at Salah's run, he's always out to win. He's constantly making those runs. And if Fernandes can have that, you know, link-up play with Rashford and Martial in that team, you're looking at great attacking forces. And back to the United at old that we used to see, that were constantly attacking back in the early 2000s. And when you were winning everything, they were constantly attacking. It was always goals from them. And you had people driving the midfield at the time, and hopefully you can get that back, because you know they've always been one of the biggest teams in the world. It was great to have them back, you know, contending for the Premier League again with Liverpool, City, and the more teams you can get going for the league like that and improving, then great. And Solskjaer said he's not there yet. You know, there's money there to be spent on certain players, you know, the right players, and he seems to have complete control on the right players he wants at the club now. Then they might be a contender in time to come. And, you know, they've shown all the good signs of going the right way.
Yeah, getting a hit like Fernandes would give anybody confidence that he knows what he's doing in the transfer window. There was two other quick stories about Irish players that I just wanted to get your take on. I might start with Jeff Hendrick and the possibility of him going to AC Milan. We were having this conversation a little bit earlier on about how the pace of play in Italian football might actually be something that suits Hendrick. And it was interesting when Sean Dyche was issuing his statement thanking him, he said that he played very well in a lot of different positions. And I think, Jonathan, it'd be great to hear you explain to us a little bit about what his role was within the Ireland team, because it seems like he played quite a lot of different positions as opposed to just midfield or right side of midfield for Ireland. And that might have had an impact on his ability to impact games a little bit.
It is. If you look at players, you'll have certain players in fixed positions. You'll always have centre-halves. You'll have players that will play as wing-backs in a three. You'll have players like your traditional left-back, right-back. Then you'll have a sitting midfielder. And for years, it's been Glenn Whelan. That's his sort of position. And Jeff, because he's technically very good, and he is very, very good technically on both feet in tight areas and everything, and because he's a good lad, he'll work extremely hard for the team, and I've seen how hard he works day in, day out, and then just through the stats and things like that, then you will get moved around quite a lot, because you'll do a job, and you might not be doing a 10 out of 10 every week, but you'll do a job that the manager will trust you in that position, and he'll trust to move you around. And sometimes then you'll get a little bit lost in terms of the manager and the players will know what you're doing for the team, but the fans might be like, oh, what's Jeff doing playing? He's not doing great. But really, as a player, when he's in your team, you know he's doing a great job for you. So for years for Burnley, he's played, they played two up front for a while, and he was sort of before I came, they were playing two up front with Bokes and Barnes, and he was sort of a midfielder then, but he might go right, he might go left. But then when he played one up front, he was that one that played in behind, and he didn't really have a role of a midfielder. He was trying to make runs in behind, and he wouldn't really get on the ball a lot. And it was really frustrating for him, and I could see it. It was frustrating for him, and I knew it was frustrating for him because I'd speak to him. And then when they come in the Ireland setup, it's depending who you play against, and who you're setting up against, and where you position him. A great one for me was the Italy game, which was the other day. It was 4 years ago, wasn't it? And the other day they played in a diamond, and they moved them around with Robbie and Jeff and Wes, and it worked really well. And for me, that was his position. He can rotate midfield, he can get on the ball, he can turn, he can go forward, he can drive, he can link up with the strikers. You get him around the edge of the box, he has an unbelievable shot on him as well. And he has a bit of freedom there rather than just being, look, you're going to play behind the striker. You're going to be a number 10. We're not going to play to link up through you because we 95% of our play is going to be long. So we want you to get in the channel balls and pick up second balls. And really, that's not his role. I think Jeff's technically a very good player. He's probably been frustrated. He's been great that he's been playing Premier League so long for Burnley, but he's been frustrated because it's not his preferred role. And if he went to an Italian team or something like that, the pace will be slower. But Jeff can play at a high tempo. Just put him in the right position to play in that. He's very good with his feet technically in tight areas at other midfielders. You put him in a box in a training game, it's very hard to get it off, and he can move the ball very quickly, and he's a powerful player.
Kenny, the other story that I just wanted to get your take on was Stephen Ireland's back in the paper saying that he wants to make a bit of an Ireland comeback to just to put a bow or to maybe...
A bit like John Spare. I'm going to come back.
I almost didn't recognise him. I mean, the rest of the world has gone shaved heads in lockdown, and Jonathan Walters has this amazing... Where has this been all your life, Jonathan?
Paying him a compliment before we came on air.
It's born, yeah. It's a lockdown haircut, isn't it? It's just grown. The grey's still in there. To be fair, when I was a player, I always wanted it short. I always wanted it to look like it was, you know, it had to be sharp and look like it was a meant business.
Ireland's George Clooney.
This is the longest it's ever been. It might stay as well, you know. I don't know. It might stay. I tell you what, with that product in now, it's out of control. It needs the water or gel in it because... It gets very bushy.
I see a future for you for endorsements here. Your agent should be recommending that you keep it. Whoever your agent is these days, it's like, look, keep it. It suits you. Speaking of hair, Stephen Ireland, Kenny, any chance of a comeback for Ireland when he's not even playing football at the moment? Is this pie in the sky or do you think it's possible?
Well, you've caught me by surprise there. I hadn't heard that story personally. It's good to hear he has the kind of motivation, still got the ambition that he wants to come back. And play for Ireland.
Am I hearing this right, Steve? is that right?
Yes. So he did an interview yesterday with Daniel Taylor in The Athletic, and apparently he's training with Bruno Fernandes. Footage emerged of himself and a couple of the other Man United players. Who's he with? So he's with Bruno Fernandes and...
Diogo Dalot.
Yeah. And they're training, and he wants to play. You played with him for a good while, didn't you, Johnny?
Yeah, look, technically, Stevie was always one of the best players in training. It was just, you know, and he had a terrible injury, to be fair. He had a really bad leg break, really bad. It took him a long time to try and come back from that. I don't think he was ever right when he came back at the time I was at Stoke. Technically, though, he was up there, but he was one of those where he'd be so good in training that you wouldn't really see the best of him in the game, whether it be some injuries. A few times I did play with them now. So I was talking about players before that always look forward, always look to put you in. He put me in quite a few times. I used to love playing with him in behind. As soon as he got turned, I'd already made my run before he left the ball and he could see it. But I just don't know. You caught me by surprise here as well. I saw him play in a Man City charity game not too long ago. And he was looking... it was about a year ago, actually. He wasn't looking...
A bit chunky.
He was looking a little bit heavy. I know he likes his mad training. He goes on random training sessions and does all sorts. So whether he's got himself really fit, I don't know. Do you fancy a comeback, Kenny? Me and you as well.
And do you know what? Good luck. At least he's got a bit of ambition. It's unlikely, you know, you have your time and that's it, and you move on. But do you know what? We're talking about kind of positive vibes. Nice to hear some positive energy from people. So, you know, I'd say good luck to him. I take your point in terms of his career. And from a technical level, you're talking about Jeff, John. Steve was as good as anything I've seen. I didn't play with him up close. I didn't have to look at him on the screen. I think, oh my God, this lad, in terms of his close control, ball manipulation, and like you said, getting himself into half turn and playing, was as good as we... If he came along just in a different era, maybe at a different time, you know, he could easily have been a player. He could be talking about 70 or 80 Ireland caps. He really was that good.
You know what, if he's been training, as you said there, he does live in the area and he's friendly with a lot of those players. He lives in that sort of Hale, Wilmslow, Old Liege area. And if he is doing training, he might be doing the small-sided stuff or the technical stuff, and he's probably thinking, I'm as good as DZ, and he is. To be fair, he will be as good.
Yeah.
But I think top level now, I think is you're an athlete. I think you've got to do it for 90 minutes, you're an athlete. So if he is thinking about a comeback, at what level that will be, I don't know. Because I think at Premier League level, even Championship now, it is full on. You've got to be an athlete for 90 minutes. And these players aren't just technically good. They're machines now. It's like highly tuned machines. It's very difficult. So if you can get him in any sort of, I don't know
if he's
having you one or not. I don't know.
fair enough. that sentence almost reached an end. It didn't quite make it there. Lads, great to have you with us this morning. Thanks a million. The Peter Brady Memorial Fund is available on GoFundMe, and the link is in Jonathan Walters' Twitter bio as well. It's the Ireland versus Bosnia match-worn shirt. A big night in Irish football history, and a big night in Jonathan Walters' career, and the match-worn shirt from that is available. You just need to make a donation to a very good cause, and as I said, we'll tweet that, and the link is in Jonathan Walters' bio as well. Good stuff, lads. Thanks a million for being with us this morning.
Thanks, guys. Thanks very much.
Tonight, from 7 o'clock, John Giles joins Nathan, then there's live Premier League commentary of Manchester City against Chelsea. The best place to listen, as I said, is the OTB Sports app, where you can download right now. Will we finally see Liverpool win the league tonight?
25 yards out, just to the right of centre. Alexander-Arnold steps up, gets it over and smashes it into the back of the net. Trent Alexander-Arnold scores. Wonderful free kick. And the local boy sends Liverpool one step closer to the promised land. It could be a chance for second. Salah's in behind. Salah scores. And that should be that. Mo Salah makes it Liverpool 2. Crystal Palace 0. A long ball forward. And he took it on his instep. Perfect control from the Egyptian. And then with his left foot just touched it past the onrushing Wayne Hennessy. And just before half-time, Liverpool have doubled their advantage. A 17th Premier League goal of the season for who else but Mo Salah. It's Liverpool 2. Palace 0. Fabinho from a long, long way. Oh, what a goal. Fabinho. He must have been 35 yards out there, just step back, right foot, and like a bullet past Wayne Hennessy, and Liverpool in total control, lead by 3-0. He scored a cracker, a hugely important goal against Manchester City at the opposite end of the pitch back in January. This one was even better. Brazilian brilliance, and Fabinho makes it Liverpool 3, Crystal Palace 0. To Salah, first time forward, releases Mane. Could be a chance for Fort. First big opportunity, Sadio Mane on his right foot, gets the shot off and buries it into the back of the net. Liverpool clinical, one mistake from Townsend, and a rapid fire attack from Firmino to Salah, who provided the assist. And we had just said he'd had a quiet game, Sadio Mane, but he made no mistake. Plenty of time to think about it when he was released first time from deep, from inside his own half by Mo Salah, onside Sadio Mane. And we've seen him with that finish so many times this season. Right footed low into the bottom right hand corner. 15 in the Premier League for Sadio Mane. 4-0 to Liverpool with 22 minutes to go.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.